Now, I met David Howard 40 years ago at Cedar Campus. He came as a missionary direct from his work in Columbia to our missionary camp up at Cedar Campus. And Butch Dickerson and I were the only two international student workers that attended that camp. And we thought, this is the best intervarsity experience that we've had ever. And we wanted to come back the next summer because people like David were so inspiring for us. Well, they rotated staff into those rather unusual missionary camps, so we never got to go back to it. But I always look back on that as a foundation stone in my early staff life, to be exposed to men like Dave Howard. My next experience with Dave was working together with him in an Urbana Missions Convention preparation. He spoke at Urbana 67, and then in 73, I had the privilege of working under David to help with things like bus shuttle arrangements and charters from across the country and personnel assignments and Bible study preparations. And in those days, a few of us did a lot of things. Now a lot of us do a lot of things. Urbana has gotten so big. And David was a marvelous guy to work under and for. Now, some of you know David quite well, but I think others of you, maybe most of you, don't. So let me give you a few of the things that he's done in his very illustrious career. He not only served in Latin America with the LAM, the Latin American Mission, for 16 years in Costa Rica and Colombia, but he was also the international director following that for 10 years of World Evangelical Fellowship. And he was the one who helped plan and run the Lausanne Committee for World Evangelization when it met in 1980. He worked for 3 years for that Lausanne group and was the director of the world of the consultation on world evangelism in Thailand. He was senior vice president of Cook Communications, and then for a number of years in the 90s, he was president of the Latin America Mission. They invited him back out of one of his many retirements to take over the mission for a short time until they found a younger man. So David has done all sorts of missionary activity. He went to Wheaton College, and some of you have seen The End of the Spear. How many of you have actually seen that film? Good number of you. Well, David's best friend was one of those martyred in that Alca experience, Jim Elliott. Jim was his best man at his wedding. And it turned out that David's sister Elizabeth married Jim. And to give you an idea of the kind of nitty-gritty missionary vision that these people had, Elizabeth and Nate Saint's wife went back into that Alca tribe after those martyrs were killed and lived among them for a number of years and were instrumental in helping that whole tribe eventually, pretty much whole tribe, come to know the Lord Jesus. Dave can elaborate a bit on that if he wants to, but we're dealing here with a man who is a missionary's missionary, who has not only a love for the Lord Jesus Christ, but also a love for his kingdom work, and has given his entire life to it. So I want you to join me in welcoming David Howard to our next.
Thank you, Ned. Thank you for your warm welcome. Thank you, Shirley, for using the old InterVarsity hymnbook. I was involved in preparing that one because that was our official hymnbook at Urbana 76. It was published in 76. So it was fun. I get nostalgic when I see it being used again. Well, this is wonderful to get back here and see some old friends from way back, like Ned, and I see others here, Leighton and Lisa, others, whom I've known for a good many years, and most of you, of course, are new to me. When I was involved here with InterVarsity, our offices were down on Langdon Street. I was never in this building, but it's just really great to be back, and I appreciate you giving me this time. I understand you had to upset the apple cart completely and change the day for this meeting and everything, so you're very gracious and kind. I thought I would just share with you some of the things that God tried to teach me in my years in InterVarsity, or some of the opportunities God gave me. I say tried to teach me because I don't claim that I learned all the lessons the Lord has over the years tried to teach me, but I've I'd been blessed of God, and my years in university were a very, very significant part of my life, right? Sort of in the middle of my life, my ministry having been in Latin America for many years first and then back here and so on. My first relationships with university go back to my college years. I went to Wheaton College in 1945, right after the war. And the Student Foreign Missions Fellowship, which was part of InterVarsity, was active on the campus, and I became quite active in that group on campus. Jim Elliott was president our senior year of the, we just called it FMF in those days, and Jim and I worked very closely together in missions activities on the Wheaton College campus, and he had a profound influence on my life. As Ned mentioned, we were roommates and became best man in my wedding, so I was grateful for the influences there. I went to the first Urbana convention, which was held in Toronto in 1946. I was a sophomore in college that year. I'll tell you a little more about how that came to be as I go on here for a moment. But, you know, that was the first effort. And it was, we thought, a huge convention. There were 575 of us there. And really, and I'm not kidding. We thought this was really great. It was so good. It was so successful that InterVarsity decided, well, we better try this again. Let's try it again 2 years later, and let's get it to a more central location. Toronto's pretty far east. So they found the University of Illinois had the facilities needed. So in 1948, it was moved there, and I attended that convention as well. I was a senior then. Jim Elliott and I went there together to that convention. And then, of course, it moved on every three-year basis after that. When it jumped from 575 students at Toronto, it jumped up to almost 1,300 at Urbana, and people were immediately saying, well, this is too big, we're going to have to break it up. And get literally, that's what people were saying. But I'm grateful for the tremendous influence on my life in those days of many. See, I was part of the what you might call the post-World War II generation of missionaries. I was not a veteran of the war. I turned 18 just immediately after the war ended, so I never went into the service. I started college as a typical freshman, 17, 18 years old. But the veterans from the war were coming back at that time. The U.S. government had just passed the GI Bill of Rights, which meant that the government would pay the way through college of anyone who'd served in the military during that war, which meant that the college campuses were literally flooded. Millions, literally, and that's not an exaggeration, millions and millions of students were pouring in to the college campuses. And the Christian men and women who came to a Christian school like Wheaton, Christians went to other places as well and had an influence, but since I was at Wheaton, they had a tremendous influence on me. And the reason being, that generation of students was different from any generation either before or since, as far as I can tell, for several reasons. One was, they were older than the average entering class of students because they'd been in a service. In that war, you didn't go in for 18 months and come out. If you went in at the beginning of the war, you stayed until the war was over. And some went in at the beginning when the war started. For us, at least, it started in Pearl Harbor, 1941. So our military people who went in 41, 42, 43, they were there till the war was over. So they came back to college. They were several years older than the average entering student. So they were more mature. And also, they were much more mature in the sense that they had they'd faced life and death. They'd seen death, and they knew what it was all about. They knew what life was about, and they had appreciation of life. Many of them themselves were crippled because of the war. I can remember a lot of students on campus in those days, they were on crutches because they'd lost limbs. My debate colleague, I was on the debate team, he'd lost a hand. He had one hand, that sort of thing. So they had a great influence as mature men and women who had faced life and death. And another thing, they had seen the world. No previous student generation had ever seen the world the way they had. They'd been all through North Africa, Italy, France, Germany, Middle East, and then, of course, all through the Pacific Islands. And so they had a world view that no previous student generation had ever had. And they had a desire, many of these Christian men and women had a great desire to go back to those areas of the world that they had seen so utterly devastated. They'd seen the results, and they wanted to go back there. And so they actually were founding mission societies. You may or may not be aware that MAF, Mission Aviation Fellowship, came right out of World War II. It was founded by pilots who said, and mechanics, they said, look, Uncle Sam taught us how to fly. Let's put that to work on behalf of missions. So the whole concept of missionary aviation really came out of World War II. There had been one or two smaller programs prior to that, but the real movement of mission aviation came from those men and women who founded that. Far Eastern Gospel Crusade, which is today Send International, was founded by veterans who fought in the Pacific. Greater Europe Mission was founded by veterans who fought in Europe. And so they and these fellows and women were on the campus with us in those days. So they influenced me tremendously, and I'm thankful for that. They were serious-minded, I mentioned. They'd seen life and death. And while they knew how to have fun, they also were serious-minded. They were men and women of prayer. You used to say during the war, there are no atheists in the foxholes. And they had done they'd done a lot of praying. One of my classmates, a fellow named Art Weens, had been in the service for quite a while. He'd been through North Africa and then through all the terrible fighting, the long boot of Italy. And Art came back to campus with a great view for prayer. He was a real man of prayer. He's a quiet man. If you ever met Art Weens somewhere, you wouldn't pick him out of a crowd. He's rather shy and sort of withdrawn. But he really knew how to pray. And he got a vision. He wanted personally to pray for every student by name on the Wheaton College campus. Now, it was a small school, 1,500. But he got the college directory. And he prayed for 10 students per day right through the college directory, praying that God would choose the ones of his choice, send them out to the mission field. And the result was that many went. I did not see Art after graduation. We graduated together, class of 49. He went right back to Italy, and he's still there today. He's retired. He's in his 80s, but he's still back in Italy, been there all of his adult life. And I saw him again for the first time after 25 years at the Lausanne Congress on World Evangelization in Lausanne, Switzerland in 1974. That was 25 years after our graduation. And Art said to me, he said, Dave, you remember those prayer meetings we used to have at Wheaton? Well, we had a lot of them. We used to pray a lot for the campus in early morning prayer. He said, I'm still praying for 500 of our contemporaries from that period of time who went to the mission field. I said, how do you know they went? He said, I kept in touch with the alumni office to find out who from our era went to the field. There's 500 of us. I said, could I see your prayer list? Yes. He brought it to me the next day, an old battered notebook in which he'd written by hand the names of students as they went to the mission field. I found my wife's name there, her maiden name first, Phyllis Gibson, and he'd added in a different pen, Howard, when we got married. He kept up to date with that. I didn't see Art again for about 15 years. I saw him again one time at a conference. He said, Dave, I'm praying for 580 of our contemporaries now because more in sort of a midlife or later life have been going to the mission field. So, you know, there was that kind of emphasis going on. Jim Elliott, who president of the FMF and one of the other FMF leaders, they made a great big chart, would cover, be as big as those two more put together, which they divided up the hours of the day, 24 hours a day, right around the clock for the month. And they asked students, divided by 15-minute periods. They asked students to sign up for any 15-minute period on the 24-hour scale and promise to pray during that 15 minutes for missions emphasis on the Wheaton College campus. And that chart got filled. Students literally did fill their name in. So they would set an alarm clock for 2 o'clock in the morning, get out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and pray till 2:15, knowing that somewhere on campus another alarm clock's going off and somebody else getting up at 2:15 and praying till 2:30, right around the clock. So there was this tremendous emphasis, which I was thrilled to be part of that and see what was happening. It obviously greatly influenced me, these older men who knew so much more about the world than we younger fellows did. And so I'm just grateful that God allowed me to be there at that period of time. I mentioned going to the Toronto Convention in 1946. In those days, InterVarsity used the World Evangelism decision cards that they still used, and I signed one of them there. And there it is. It's got my name, and it's got the date, 1946, that I signed at Toronto. It's brown now. Some of you close by can see a little green spot there. That's where I had it tacked with a thumbtack over my desk in college to remember to pray every day about a commitment that I had made to the Lord at Toronto. And the rest of it faded, but that little green spot reminds me of what that was. I pulled this out many years later, and was thankful to the Lord for even a little thing like that, which for me had a great influence. It reminded me every day to pray about a commitment which I had made to the Lord for foreign missionary service. And the Lord honored that, and so the whole rest of my life has been involved in one form or another in missions work, whether it was directly overseas or through Urbana and things of that nature. So I'm very grateful for all of that. Now, while I was still in college, Stacy Woods, who was the founder of InterVarsity in the U.S., came to me and recruited me to come on staff after graduation. So I did. I joined the staff of InterVarsity in 1949 after graduation. I spent one year full-time on the staff. Then I got married in the summer of 1950, went back to graduate school, and stayed on part-time on staff. But the year 49 to 50, I was what they called in those days mission staff member. And I was primarily working with the FMF chapters around it, but also the InterVarsity chapters. In those days, U.S. and Canada was one movement. So I covered the entire United States and Canada. I literally did. I lived out of a suitcase. I traveled all over both countries throughout the course of the year. Most InterVarsity staff today and subsequent have one or two campuses maybe. I visited 120 campuses in the course of that year. And it was a great experience for me. I've often felt I don't think I really contributed much to InterVarsity. I mean, here I am green behind the ears. I'm just barely out of college. I've never been to the mission field myself. We didn't have summer outreach in those days or anything of that sort. So I knew nothing about missions except, you know, second, third hand what I learned. And there I was trying to recruit other students for missions work. And I think in hindsight, as I say, I've often wondered, what did I ever do in those days for InterVarsity? Probably not much. But it did a lot for me. I learned a lot. But then, just about 3 years ago, I got a letter. It's dated March 1st, 2003. It's from a student who I apparently met. I would not know him if I saw him on the street at one of the universities out in the state of Washington. And he wrote me a handwritten letter in 2003. And he was a student in 1950 at a school in one of the Eastern Washington University. He said, "I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for the way the Lord used you in my life." That was in the early 50s while you were with IVCF. And then he goes on to tell me that apparently my visit to that campus, which I could barely remember having been there, I wouldn't know him if I saw him on the street. He says, "My brother Dave and my cousin Dean and my future wife Elaine, were all our lives are completely turned around with that brief visit, which couldn't have been more than 2 days at the most." And then he went on to say, "Dave went to Papua New Guinea, Dean went to Bolivia, and I've spent the rest of my life in Brazil." So somehow or other, whatever was said, and I wouldn't have any idea what all I might have said to those three students in 1950, but all three of them spent the rest of their lives in Papua New Guinea, Bolivia, and Brazil. So that kind of thing, you know, once in a while in InterVarsity circles, we'll get things like that. And some of you more mature former staff here probably can look back and thank God for students who have said similar things to you. And younger staff should be encouraged to know that the seed that's being planted, we may not see the results of that for a long, long. We may never see the results of some of that. But when God graciously allows us to see that, it's just very wonderful. Well, I was thankful for that. Then I went back to Wheaton College for graduate school to get a master's, and I worked half-time with InterVarsity. I was the campus staff member for Northwestern University for just that 1 year. And I went out from Wheaton to Northwestern every week and met there with students for Bible study and so on. Again, I don't think I made much impact there. In fact, it was a discouraging time for me. We had a campus mission during that year, that is an evangelistic mission, with a great teacher and speaker from England, Leith Samuel. Dr. Wells, did you ever know Leith Samuel? You probably would have, wouldn't you? Great man for student work, and he had campus missions all over the U.S. for 1 year there, including Northwestern University. And I was in charge of that. 35 students turned in cards that week to indicate they wanted to accept the Lord. And for the next 6 months or more, I prayed every day for those students by name. But as far as I could tell, and I tried to follow them up, I was not able to find even one of them that went on following the Lord. Now, maybe some did. But in my efforts of trying to disciple them, mentor them, help them, pray for them every day, I saw no results at all that I would be aware of. Maybe someday in heaven I'll find out that some of them became faithful to the Lord. But that was tough in one sense, but it was an experience also to realize that I just have to trust the Lord for the results. And then my next year in graduate school, they asked me to become assistant director of Urbana 51, which was the third Urbana, 46 Toronto, 48 Urbana, then 51. So I served as assistant director of that convention, working behind the scenes under Wes Gustafson, who was the director of it. And that was a good experience for me. I had to do a lot of work behind the scenes, like Ned was talking about, all the behind-the-scenes work that has to be done, and you all know plenty about that, I'm sure. Then we went to the mission field and spent the next 15 years or so in Latin America. I was back occasionally on furlough, and I spoke at Urbana 57 and again at 61. And this was quite an experience for me, 1966, I was back in the States doing some recruitment and all for our mission, and InterVarsity asked me to speak at some of their chapters. So I did. I was invited to speak at Harvard. On a Sunday morning, I spoke at Park Street Church in Boston, and the president of the Harvard IVCF came to church to talk to me. I was going to speak the next night at a fraternity house, going to be one of these frat gatherings, you know, they'll have, and he wanted me to speak there. This was the middle 60s. The whole counterculture movement was getting started by that time. It hadn't reached its climax yet, which really came about 1970, but the negative feelings of everything were there, the radical students and so on. And right at that time, theologically, the God is dead movement was the heyday, big thing. God is dead. Everybody's talking about that. So they asked me to speak at Harvard on God is dead. Man, I'm a backwoods missionary out of Columbia. I knew nothing about that sort of thing. But this InterVarsity president comes to me at Park Street, asks me, he wants to introduce me. He says, well, what have you done on the field? Well, I mentioned a few things. I mentioned having my first term, having taught in a seminary in Costa Rica, which was a small seminary and not really up on the level of seminaries today. But so he picked up on this and he said, well, what did you teach? Well, I kind of rattled it off. In those days, you had to be a jack of all trades. We didn't have departments and divisions. I just taught anything that had to be taught. So he said, well, what did you teach? Well, I taught Bible survey, and I taught Greek, and I taught apologetics, and I taught archaeology and a few things like this. I didn't realize what he was doing. I go to Harvard the next afternoon, this next evening, go to this fraternity house, and hear great big posters around. Come and hear Professor David Howard, professor of Greek archaeology apologetics, speak on God is dead. Well, we got started, and I didn't get to first base. I mean, those students, these Harvard students at this fraternity house, it's informal, you know, they jumped on me, and they chewed me to bits. I mean, I was absolutely demolished by the end of that time. Oh, and I got out of there as fast as I could. I said, okay, I worked with students back in the 50s, but I'm finished with that now. No more of this for me. You know, I can't communicate anymore to students. And forgot about it. The next year, 67, we were home on furlough. Keith Hunt asked me to come, and Keith and I were old friends from way back. He asked me to come and speak to one of his student weekend conferences in Michigan. I said, forget it, Keith. I told him about my Harvard experience. No, Dave, he said, these students, they're not quite like Harvard anyway, here in eastern Michigan. He said, just come and be yourself. Just be a missionary. Just be yourself and share from your heart to the students. Well, very reluctantly, I'll give it a try. So I did. And we had an absolutely wonderful, wonderful weekend. Just a great time. The Lord was there very clearly dealing with us, I'm sure. And so then at 67 Urbana, I was there also. That conference in Michigan was probably in the spring of 1967. Or no, I guess it was the fall. Whatever. Then Urbana 67 in December. At the end of that convention, Dr. John Alexander, the president of InterVarsity, came to me, told me that the missions director, Eric Fife, was under doctor's orders to give up his position. His health was crumbling, and they said, we need a new mission director, and we're convinced that you're God's man to do this job. He was very forceful about it, very straightforward. We really believe, said, I've talked with my colleagues and all, and you're the man God wants here. I said, I'm due back on the field next month. I've got to go back to Latin America. Well, he said, that's okay, go back, but will you pray about it? I said, okay, I'll pray. So I prayed for about 2 months and had no leading from the Lord to accept. I'm already back in Latin America. So I wrote John and I said, forget it, look for somebody else. He wrote back, he said, I'm convinced you're God's man for this job. Will you please pray a little longer? So I prayed 2 more months. I turned him down a second time. Went through the same cycle, 2 more months, and I turned him down a third time. Well, 3 strikes and you're out. So I didn't expect to hear from him again. But after I turned him down a third time, I didn't hear from him for about a month. But during that time, for some reason or other, in my own heart, I was really churned up. I'd gotten really turned on at Urbana 67 and also at that conference with Keith Hunt, the potential of students. And this is, by now, we're getting to the height of the protest generation, the negative generation, about everything, you know. This is really building up to the counterculture people, you know, the radicals. And I thought, well, it'd be a real challenge to try to get into that generation of students and work on behalf of missions, because they were so negative about missions. They're negative about everything, you know, the church, society, education, government, the whole bit. But missions, oh boy, we really came in for it. So, but I felt challenged, but I had no leading from the Lord. So finally, in my own turmoil and wondering, Lord, is this lack of peace about this really from you or not? And so one day in my journal, I do keep a journal. Jim Elliott's the guy who got me into journaling. I wrote these words. I said, Lord, if this invitation from InterVarsity is really from you, and you do want me to leave Latin America, where I expected literally to spend the rest of my life, have John Alexander write back just one more time. I didn't expect he would. This is the fourth time now we're talking about. And have him at least leave the door open. That was the words I wrote in my journal. At least leave the door open. So if he left the door open, then I'd say, okay. Well, about a month later, I get a letter from John Alexander, and he said, I've been away on vacation, that's why you haven't heard from me. But he said, you're the first letter I picked up, and I get back to my office, and I want to write right away. He said, apparently God is not leading you in our direction, so we will not be bothering you further. Okay, second paragraph. But if in the meantime God should give you any green light, may I leave the door open? He literally used word for word what I had written in my journal. Now, I don't hear voices from God. I'm not one of those fortunate people that seem to hear God speak, but that was as close as I think I've ever come to hearing an audible voice from God, when he almost seemed to say, that's what you asked for, okay, there it is. Now you go back to the States. And so immediately, I picked up the phone right away from Costa Rica and called John, said, have you found anybody else to fill? No, we still need you. So obviously the Lord brought me back here. By that time, plans for Urbana 70 were well underway. Paul Little had been named director of Urbana 70, and I became his assistant working under Paul, and I was so thankful that I was not the director. Urbana 70 was a tough, tough time. It was really a rough time, because that was the height of all the student protests. If you remember historically what's going on, the Kent State students, four of them, were killed in the spring of 1970. And the mathematics building right here on this campus was blown up in August of 1970. Those were the climaxes of all the protests. And when the Kent State students were killed, you know, campuses erupt all over the place. It was just, you know, Berkeley was probably number one, but Wisconsin came pretty close to probably being number two in terms of upheavals and disruption and all that. We used to kid John Alexander in those days, because prior to that, the InterVarsity offices used to be in Chicago. In fact, when I came back to the States, they were still in the Loop, downtown Chicago. But John used to say to us, because he'd been a head of the geography department here for many, many years, the university was his bailiwick, he said, I feel that for a student movement, we need to be close to a campus. We need to feel the throb, he'd say. We want to feel the throb of a student position. And then he said, we ought to smell the gun smoke and all that. So we moved to Madison, took the place over there on Langdon Street. And Langdon Street is about one block off of where the National Guard set up its headquarters when things exploded in 1970. And the National Guard was almost outside our windows. And there was all sorts of disruption going on, and tear gas being thrown. The tear gas would come floating in the windows of the InterVarsity office, and we'd say, John, you enjoying the gun smoke? Well, those were good days for us. And, about that time, or just prior to that, I was invited by Gordon Conwell Seminary to speak for a week at an intercession course they had there. And the topic they gave me, I didn't really understand exactly what they wanted, but it was the influence of students on missions. Now, up to that time, I had some vague ideas about Haystack Prayer Meeting and student volunteer movement and stuff like that, but I didn't really know much about it. And they asked me to lecture for a whole week, 4 or 5 hours a day. So I had a lot of work to do. I went into the Missionary Research Library in New York City to prepare for this series of lectures on students and their influence on the missions movement, not having any idea really where I was going to go. While I was in the Missionary Research Library, you know, you've heard the phrase of a divine appointment. Well, I think God gave me a divine appointment that day because I saw a fellow sitting over the table doing some work. I'd met him once. I knew his name. His name was Denton Lotz, and I saw him there, but he was absorbed in what he was doing. He had books all over the table. He had papers spread out and very much absorbed. I thought, well, I won't interrupt him. I don't really know him that much anyway. I just met him once, and I almost walked out. And then I thought, no, I'll just go say hi to Denton Lotz. So I went over there. He was right then at the height of working on a PhD dissertation on the watchword of the student volunteer movement, which was the evangelization of the world in this generation. He was doing a PhD on that watchword. And he had all the files and everything about the student volunteer movement that had been founded in 1886, had been a tremendous forward movement, and what had happened to it and how it grew so tremendously, and thousands of students were challenged and went overseas. But then in 1920, they had a major turnaround and a reaction against the former things, and they cut out their missions emphasis and turned into social concern and political work and all of that, and the whole student volunteer movement, as a result, went down the drain. Well, Denton Lotz gave me all of this stuff. He had all of this stuff laid out there, things I never could have found myself. I mean, he's a PhD man, and I would not have ever been able to find all the intricate archives and things that he'd been able to dig out. Well, that was a tremendous help to me, and it helped me prepare for these lectures, which I was to give at Gordon-Conwell, which I did. Well, then, in 1970, as we're preparing for Urbana 70, the students of that generation, this was the height, as I said, of the radicalism. And those students were saying to us, they wanted us to change the whole Urbana Convention, get away from the irrelevant, as they put it, irrelevant things like world evangelism, prayer, Bible study. Let's get with the real issues of the day. And the real issues of the day to them were, you know, war, poverty, women's issues, racism, economic injustice, all of those things. And they wanted us to turn the whole Urbana Convention into that. Now, my mind clicked. In 1886, when the student volunteer movement was formed at a conference grounds where D.L. Moody was the organizer, and the students actually organized this, 1886, and they took this watchword, the evangelization of the world in this generation, became a tremendous forward movement up until 1920, 34 years later, when they used to have quadrennial conventions. Our Urbana conventions have been, InterVarsity recognizes its debt to the student volunteer movement for the idea of nationwide conventions. The SVM was doing that every 4 years. InterVarsity made it every 3 years. But in 1920, there was a revolt by radical students against the original purposes of the SVM, and they said, and it's all documented there, and I found all this in the documentation. In the documentation, they said, your founders, which was 34 years before, your founders were swept up in irrelevant stuff like world evangelism, Bible study. We're going to change the world and get rid of the problems. See, they were just out of World War I. And they said, your generation took us through a useless, bloody world war. We're going to rid the world of war and poverty and economic injustice and racism. Those were the issues that they talked about in 1920. In 1970, students were coming to us and saying exactly the same thing. And my mind clicked. Student Foreign Missions Fellowship, I didn't tell you all about that, but the FMF, which later became part of InterVarsity, was founded by students in 1936, totally by students. They joined InterVarsity in 1945, became the Missions Department of InterVarsity. But in 36, they founded that. 1936 to 1970, 34 years. 1886 to 1920, 34 years. And all of a sudden, it dawned on us, the students of 1970 were saying to us exactly what the students of SVM said in 1920, and that destroyed the SVM. By the mid-30s, SVM was done for. Went right down the drain because they did not stick with what God had called them to do. This was frightening. It really was frightening. Because even at that convention, in the middle of the week, and down at Urbana, students were after us in the middle of the week to change the whole program for the rest of the week and turn it into politically oriented and social oriented issues that they said, this is what we really ought to be talking about. And in fact, they almost became violent, some of them. Ned knows some of this story, but the security forces at the University of Illinois in 1970, they were out in force. They had to be, because the students were after us, and they were threatening violence. And one night, Paul Little came back to his room in the student union at Urbana, and he was waylaid by a group of several radical students who wanted right then and there to have a knockdown, drag-out discussion about the whole rest of the week. And they wanted Paul to change the whole program for the rest of the week and get rid of this irrelevant stuff that Urbana was all about and get with the big issues. They got so violent, or close to violence, they tried to force their way into Paul's room at midnight. Paul had with him a staff member that we called him, Paul's bodyguard, and he really was that night a bodyguard. His name was Dick Young. And Dick was a big, strong fella. He directed Bear Trap Ranch for a while, and Dick had played hockey at the University of Minnesota when they went to the finals of the NCAA. And Dick was the hatchet man on that team. Big, strong man. And yet, as sweet and gentle and kind a man as you'd ever want to meet. I mean, Dick went into the pastor, and he's a wonderful, godly man. But that night, some of his old hockey blood boiled up. This fellow tried to force his way into Paul Little's room. Dick stepped up in the door, and he says, "You take one more step, and I've got to bash your face." And the guy backed off. That big fist of Dick's looked pretty ominous. And Dick was crushed after he thought he'd lost his testimony. You know, he felt terrible. And I said, "Dick, you said the right thing. They understood that language." Anyway, obviously, before the convention, when I began to realize this thing of 1886 to 20, 34 years, SFMF 36 to 70, 34 years, the same issues, and we're about to change, I told John Alexander. And he said, "As long as I'm president of InterVarsity, we will always hold to what God called us to do at Urbana, which is the worldwide outreach of the church. And we will not allow ourselves to be sidetracked into perfectly legitimate issues." Nobody's going to say that those issues are anything wrong with those issues. But that's not what God called us to do at Urbana. And so we stuck with it, and I'm very thankful for that. Now, I was so thankful that Paul Little was director of Urbana 70. I learned under him. You know, I had just come back from backwoods of Columbia, and I had no idea. I had much more culture shock coming back to the U.S. campuses in the late 60s, early 70s than I ever had when I first went to the mission field. I mean, it was real culture shock. And I'm thankful that I was able to learn some things under Paul. Then John asked me to take over Urbana, which I did, 73 and 76. And I remember one time, here's another one of those divine appointments. We were preparing Urbana 73, and we'd been through all of that eruption at 70 and the difficulties. On a plane one day from Pittsburgh to Chicago, I ran into Bill Pennell, an African-American fellow who was teaching at Fuller at the time. And Bill had been with us at Urbana 70. He'd had a workshop with the African-Americans where there'd been big emphasis in 70 on the African-Americans. I talked to Bill. He said, "How are the plans coming for Urbana 73? And I started telling him. And by now, we're getting pressures from everybody because we had given a lot of emphasis to the African-Americans in 70. Now, every other pressure group was coming to us and saying, "Well, now, you gave them their day in 70. Our day ought to be 73. I was telling Jim Tebbe yesterday on the phone that at one point I counted up about 12 different ethnic or pressure groups, all of whom wanted us to give them their day, as it were, at Urbana 73, make a big thing for them. Jim was telling me he gets a lot of that same kind of pressure, too. And that'll always be. So I tell Bill Pennell about this, black man. Bill turned to me on the plane there, and he said, "Dave, don't you ever let any African-American or anybody else from any other pressure group or me or anybody turn you aside from God's calling to InterVarsity of Urbana, which is the worldwide mission of the church. You do that, and you'll lose the whole ballgame." He says, "You stick with what God called Urbana to be in the first place, and don't ever change." Well, I was very thankful. That put some iron in my bones, as it were, so that even the pressures we got, we didn't get as much pressure in 73. Things were changing. And one of the great changes that took place, at Urbana 70, those World Evangelism decision cards that I just showed you that I had signed in 46, only 8% of the students at Urbana 70 signed those cards. 8%. That means that 92% of the students at Urbana showed no outward response to the call of God to the world mission of the church. that was pretty discouraging. That's why I said Urbana 70 was a tough, tough time. And I was so thankful that Paul was directing and I was learning under him. But by 73, there was a dramatic change. We got 28% signed those cards. And by 76, 50% signed those cards. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that kind of response has gone on over the years. But in 73, when this big response was so different from 70, Ralph Winter jumped on me and he said, "Dave, we've got to follow up now. We've got to do something with these students." I said, Ralph's one of these guys who can think up more things in less time than anybody else. And I've often said about Ralph, he's a real genius. There's no doubt about it. He is a genius. But as a genius, he can think of 100 ideas, and time takes me to get one. And of his 100 ideas, 95 of them are harebrained, but five of them will be strokes of genius. And I give Ralph Renner great credit for his tremendous influence on missiology in the last 50 years. He is a genius, and God has used him wonderfully. Well, he jumped on me, and he said, "We got to do something." You know, after Urbana's over, I want to crash for a while. You know, 3 years working on that wears a person out. Jim, you're going to be ready to crash too in January. I know what it's like. And Barney back there, you've been through it. And I want to crash. And forget it out of my mind. But he wouldn't give up. He kept there. "You've got to do something." I said, "Well, what do you want to do?" "Well, we ought to have a summer follow-up program when we help these students who signed those cards, get them together." And so we did. I finally capitulated to him. He wanted our whole mailing list of InterVarsity. Well, InterVarsity doesn't give away mailing lists. Then he wanted just the Urbana mailing list. And after discussion, we finally made a one-time concession. And we said, "All right, Ralph, we will give you labels of that mailing list. With your understanding, you will send one letter, no more. One letter. You use the label. Don't copy those labels. You take the label. Use those labels. Send it to students who sign cards at Urbana. And then if they want to come to the summer follow-up program, fine. But you don't have any further thing than that." And he accepted that, and he upheld his part of the bargain. So we had a summer program in 1974, and that was the beginning of the Perspectives course, which is now used all over the country, a great big thick book, and follow-up programs in churches and elsewhere. That started in the summer of 74 as a direct result of Urbana 73, when there had been this change in attitude on the part of students. So, and I teach a lot now these days in that Perspectives course, and I'm thankful to be able to be involved in that way. Another aspect that God allowed me to get involved with when I came back to the States, one of the first questions that was asked of me, "Are you going to revive the old missionary training camp?" Now, Ned talked about that when H.J. Taylor, who was the chairman of the board of InterVarsity way back in the 40s and 50s, H.J. Taylor had given the property in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is today Cedar Campus. He gave that with one understanding, that any time they wanted to have a missions emphasis on that property, that took priority over anything else. And Keith Hunt, who was director up there, told me, he says, "Dave, anytime you want any missions program up here, we give you top priority for the use of that time." So the missionary training camp was started up there about 1954. And I was there in 64 with Ned. But shortly after that, it phased out. And they weren't holding it anymore for some years, or a few years at least. So when I got back to the States, 69 or so, people began to ask me, "Are you going to revive missionary training camp?" And people were saying, "What you need to do, don't be way off up there in the backwoods of northern Michigan. Take it to the inner city of Chicago. That's where things are today. The inner city." This is that period of time of all the emphasis on inner cities and all. I said, "Well, that's a fine idea, but I'm not the man to run that. I've never had any inner city experience. I've worked out in the backwoods of Columbia and other places, but I don't know inner city work." One day I was having coffee with Jim Nyquist. We were talking about this, and Jim popped off the top of his head. I don't think he thought about it much ahead of time, but Jim said, "Why don't you take him to Costa Rica?" I thought, now there's an idea. Yeah, we'll have a missionary training camp, not up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, but in Costa Rica, where we can expose them directly to another culture, cross-cultural work. We could send them out with missionaries and national workers and so on, let them see something there. And at that time, Charlie Troutman, who had formerly been general director of the InterVarsity, was now with the Latin America Mission in Costa Rica. And our mission has a wonderful camp up in the mountains there. Well, when Jim said that, my mind immediately began to just spin like this. You know, yeah, there's all sorts of things we could do down there. So we did. In 1970, we started the first, what came to be an OTC, Overseas Training Camp. We took about 50 students down, had them in a camp for the first week or so, then sent them out all over Costa Rica under the direction of national workers and missionaries and giving them exposure, then back to camp for a final week of, sort of processing what they'd been learning and all of that. And that was the beginning, the first InterVarsity summer outreach program. Now, today, of course, they're all over the world. There's, I don't know how many. Anybody know how many there are around the world today? Really? 750? Yeah, okay. So we started with 50. And now there's programs all over. In fact, a few years ago, my first wife and I were traveling through China. We were way out in Kunming in the Yunnan province in southwest China. And we went to a three-self church there. The church was absolutely jammed with Chinese people worshiping. And just before the worship service started, a whole bunch of very nice-looking young people came in, squeezed into the pews, and a fellow squeezed in next to me. And they looked like students, a very nice-looking, good-looking bunch. So I turned to him and whispered, I said, "Who are you folks? Where are you from?" He said, "We're from InterVarsity." And this was one of the summer programs, which we started in 1970 in Costa Rica, which today, now there they were way out there in southwest China. So that was a real thrill to me, too, and I was very thankful for that. And so I look back on those days just grateful for what God has done. I think God saved us in InterVarsity from going the way of the old student volunteer movement, and I give God all the credit for that. I mean, it wasn't anything I could have possibly have done. It's just that he brought things to us at the right time, and we had the right kind of leadership. John Alexander was 100% behind us in this, and he said he would not allow anything like that to go down the drain. And Paul Little, of course, was a great man of God, but we lost Paul in 75, and so he was not with us. But many others, and some of you that I'm looking at right here, helped us out in various ways in those days. And I learned a lot from the Lord, and I'm so grateful for those years that he gave me. I'm thankful that he allowed me to work under a man like John Alexander, a real great man of God. He loved the Lord deeply. He was, some people thought him perhaps a little distant in his way of doing things, but he was very strong in organization. He believed very strongly in delegation. He'd give you a job and expect you to do that job, but he wouldn't intervene. He wouldn't stick his foot in there and tell you how to do it. If he gave you the job to do, he expected you to do it. And he gave me Urbana. He expected me to do Urbana. And at the beginning of the week, when the whole staff got together before the students came, he always would say, at a certain point in the dinner we'd have there, he'd say, "As of this moment, everybody in this room is under the direction of Dave Howard, including myself." And so he put everything under my care for the next 5 days. He never pulled the rug out from under me except once. He did. Overrode me once as president. And it was in 73, I think it was, yeah. Suddenly dawned on him that my whole family was there. I come from a family of six siblings. And we were all there. My older brother Phil was a missionary in northern Canada. My sister Elizabeth Elliott was one of the speakers. Another sister, Virginia, was a missionary in the Philippines. My brother Tom was a professor at Gordon College. And my brother Jim was a pastor. So professors and pastors were also allowed to come. So every one of my siblings were there. And because of that, we'd invited my mother to come and be there as a special guest. So she was there. And John Alexander found out about this halfway through the week. He said, "Dave, I just heard your whole family is here. Is that right?" I said, "Yeah, that's right." He said, "We're going to have him on the platform tonight." I said, "Oh, no." I said, "No, none of this nepotism business. And they don't want that. He said, "They're going to be on the platform tonight." he pulled rank on me, and he did have them all on the platform, and he introduced each one. And then finally at the end, he introduced my mother as the cause of all of this. And the students just gave a rousing, roaring, stomping applause. And to this day, I've had people come to me and say, "I was at Urbana 73, and the highlight for me was that time John Alexander got your whole family up there, a family that had spent their lives in missionary work." In fact, some Chinese students told Dr. A after that, I said, "You know, what you did at Urbana really won the hearts of the Chinese students," because some of you here have Chinese background. You know, in the Oriental culture, respect for the elders is very great. And we here in our culture, especially in those days, there wasn't a whole lot of respect for elders. And so they said, "What you did at Urbana was a great thing, and we're grateful for it." Well, I could go on, but I must quit. Time is up, and I want to thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. And I thank the Lord for the wonderful years that he gave me with this great organization. I pray every day for you. I pray for Jim every day. I know something of what he's going through. Every Urbana is different, but I have a little feeling of some of the things he's going through and his staff. So the Lord bless you, and thank you so much.